Thank you very much. Based on the discussion this morning, this is the most interesting slide that you're going to see. The other announcement is that Dan Fisher is not allowed to ask questions. Fortunately, he's not here. Okay. So I'm going to tell you three stories about experimental evolution, and I'm going to start with a little introduction as to why we do what we do, which is actually a sort of deeply debatable proposition, actually. So we would really like to understand things about how life evolved, and in particular, the people who work with me are interested in how evolutionary novelty work evolved. Evolutionary novelty is a little bit like pornography. The judge who outlawed James Joyce's Ulysses defined pornography as, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. And so people's definitions of evolutionary novelty turn out to be somewhat similar. It actually turns out to be difficult to rigorously define, and because it's difficult, like many things in biology, to rigorously define, I'm not going to try. And the real problem with evolution is that we're missing this object, okay? This is a transgenerational object. This is the TARDIS, right? And so what would really be nice to do would be able to go back in time and see how things actually happened, but we don't, unfortunately, have that ability. And so what we've done in the past, sort of starting from Darwin and Wallace, is to look at extant evidence and try and infer backwards as to what happened. So originally that was paleontology. Zucker, Kandel, and Pauling in the 1960s pointed out that by far the best record of what happened in the past is recorded in the sequence of living organisms' DNAs, and that allows us to make certain inferences about evolutionary relationships and even about the structure of genomes and so on in the past. But as you go back, it gets harder and harder to do so. There are, for example, people who recreate what are called ancestral proteins. So they make probabilistic judgments based on current day sequences as to the most likely sequence of some common ancestor of proteins. And the probability is there's some large envelope of sequences that fit within the highly probable ones, and there's some serious questions about how different their properties might be. And we like to do experiments anyway. So what we do, I've been trying to think of a word for this. I'm just going to claim what we do is rigorous speculation. What I mean by speculation is we are not inferring how evolution happened, right? So if you came here to listen to inferences about how evolution actually happened, now's the time to get up and leave, because it's not what we're capable of doing, right? What we are capable of doing is taking guesses, other people's and our own, about what might have happened, and to do experiments in the laboratory to see under some set of conditions, ones that we create in the laboratory, how plausible those guesses are. So if you like, it's an existence proof that a particular thing could have happened, right? And it's really, really important for me to say to you, just because it could have happened does not mean it happened that way. But we can't think of anything better to do, and we like to amuse ourselves, so that's what we do. Okay. And so quite a lot of today's talk is going to be about multicellularity. And so the question is, what do we mean by multicellularity? And there are different sorts of multicellular organization. So here's an organism called Pandorina. It is phylogenetically related to an organism sometimes called the green yeast, Chlamydomonas reinhardti, which is a single-cell alga, and it breaststrokes and swims like this. And if you've taken a biology class, you've probably seen pictures of it. So this is an organism quite closely related to it called Pandorina, and it is in fact essentially an assembly of 8 clammy cells organized in a geometric array, and so now this is 8 people joined at the hip doing breaststroke together. This is another relative. This is Volvox carteri, and so now what you can see is that there's specialization of cells. These little tiny cells here are the size of clammy, or the cells in Pandorina, so I don't have a scale bar here, unfortunately. These much bigger cells, the germ cells, these are going to go off and be the next generation. Eventually, this thing is going to break open. These things which are developing, you can see the cells on their surface are going to swim off, and the life cycle is going to repeat. And that's Johnny Depp. Okay. So there are 3 aspects of multicellularity. So the first one, obviously, is you got to stick a bunch of cells together. The second one is that you, at least to keep things genetically simple, it would be nice if you went through lineage-restricted propagules, okay? You will notice I haven't said single-cell propagules here because if you are a clump of cells that are all genetically identical and that clump breaks up to make smaller clumps that grow to make new clumps and so on, they're still lineage-restricted. You still ultimately go through single-cell bottlenecks of genetic information. You're not assemblages of different genetic lineages, and so you're still a lineage-restricted propagule, although I have put on the slide here the sort that people know and love. This is a rather nasty cross-species experiment. These are Xenopus laevis eggs. These are large 1.6 millimeter objects that lots of people, including us in the past, like to do experiments on. These are human sperm. If you mix these two things together, not much will happen, but these are convenient pictures available on the internet, okay? And the last thing, which we'll come back to in the third part of the talk, is to talk about division of labor. That is the idea that within an organism, different cells do different things. So I showed you the picture of Volvox, where there are germ cells and somatic cells. In your body, estimates are there something like about 200 different sorts of cells. And this is a single mammalian neuron in culture with all its various processes and some other cells here, just to remind you that you can do interesting and complicated things if you get different cells to do different things. Okay. So we are interested in this rigorous speculation vein, or you could just take the rigorous out, I guess you could just call it speculation, in investigating multicellularity, and we do it in two different ways. One is by engineering. So we do hypothesis testing by reconstruction. The famous last line on Richard Feynman's blackboard is, what I cannot create, I cannot understand. I mean, it's not obvious that that's actually a perfectly reasonable sentiment, but it's nice to use on slide. This attempting to engineer things at least partially defines the space of possibilities that evolution might have used. And in particular for us, it's actually often a useful preliminary to doing experimental evolution. So the one thing I'll say that for people who are interested in experimental evolution, it's actually a lot like traditional genetics in the sense that the shortest thing is actually the evolution part. The next longest thing is building the stuff that you're going to evolve, constructing and engineering strains. And by far the longest is trying to figure out what the hell you have at the end. And therefore, doing stuff at the beginning to test by engineering whether a particular pathway might be useful to follow, at least for us, saves time. And the other thing we do is experimental evolution, which means that we evolve organisms inside the laboratory. There is at least less preconception than there is here. You could quibble, obviously, with minimal. Again, it partially defines the space of possibilities. And it's limited by human ingenuity and organismal cheating. What I mean by cheating is people who do experimental evolution set up schemes inside the laboratory. They think, I want my cells to get bigger, stronger, show different electrical potential or whatever, and they impose some selection based on that, and then the cells do things to answer the selection, and quite often, as I'll show you in one of the examples I use, what the cells did is quite different from what you'd expect, and it just means basically that they're smarter than we are. Okay. So we're now going to have a little digression to talk about the evolution of novelty, because at least partly maybe it will help define it. So at least in biology, as far as I can tell, everything's defined by example. Like, I don't actually know of a single thing in biology that you can write down an unambiguous watertight definition. With a friend of mine, I once tried to do this for the cell cycle. We started out with a one sentence definition. We ended up with a page and a half definition, which was supposed to be for the preface of a book we were writing. And at that point, we scrapped it and said, in the cell cycle, the following things usually happen, period. There are, comma, however, comma, many exceptions. And that's how biology typically is.
Okay. Buy this book.
What?
To hear more, buy this book.
Well, no, the book was published in 1993. So. If you want to know what we knew about the cell cycle in 1993, buy this book. Met both Tim Hunt and I a quarter. Okay, so here we are in California, gloriously. If you were to go out prospecting, you might see this. This is a Californian tarweed. This is a little spindly, weedy plant with yellow flowers. In North and South America, there are something like between 20 and 50 different things that look much like this and are evolutionarily related to it. And if you look at the Wikipedia page about tarweeds, you'd need to be something of a botanist to look at the pictures and go, oh, this is one species and that's another. They basically look much like each other. Here is something, here are three examples from what is called the Hawaiian Silver Sword Alliance. Okay? These are a bunch of plants where it's not obvious from their morphology that you would group them into an alliance. But as people explored and did molecular genetics and ultimately sequenced them, all three of these plants, which look very different from each other and grow in different places, are the direct descendants of this object, and they are the direct descendants within the last 5 million years. Okay? And to give another example, of the 3,000 species of Drosophilid flies on the face of the planet, 700 of them are found only, or were found only, in Hawaii. Okay? And if you think that the Hawaiian archipelago accounts for 25% of the land surface of the Earth, you are a theoretical physicist, I guess. So why does Hawaii look like that? The reason that Hawaii looks like that is the Hawaiian islands are formed as the Earth's plate passes over a hot spot in the mantle and lava spills through and builds an island. And it basically builds an island every million years. So the big island on Hawaii is the newest. It's about 1 million years old, which is why you can go and see volcanoes there. And then they gradually drift off, and actually there's a chain that goes all the way back to the Kuril Peninsula in Russia. So this has been happening for some time. And basically what happens on those islands is it's a bit like Noah's Ark, but it's a very, you know, they're big 747s, and then the planes you fly to Santa Barbara from whichever airport you flew, which have more limited capacity, and you have to gate check your luggage and stuff. And that's sort of what went to Hawaii, because it's very far away from the Americas, which is where the prevailing wind and water currents go. And so a few very lucky guys got to go there. And when they got there, all their normal competitors or things who live in different niches weren't there. And so you get these explosive radiations. So it's not only true that there are 700 species of Drosophila in Hawaii, but they exhibit far greater range in ecology, morphology, and behavior than all the other Drosophilid species do in the rest of the world, because in the rest of the world it's sort of cosmopolitan and the Joneses are always trying to keep up with each other. Okay. So here's a model for how novelty might arise. And so the reason, why am I doing this? The reason is that in the experiments that I'm going to talk about, we select for large effect mutations. Estimates from simulations that I've done suggest that the typical selective benefit of the mutations that we incur in our experiments around 0.3. Okay, so at a level where all sorts of assumptions you normally make in population genetic theory to do math don't hold particularly well. Okay, and as I'll talk about later, the majority of those mutations, and perhaps at least in our experiments, all of them are mutations that kill the function of genes rather than make genes work better. Okay, and so the question is, is there any basis for believing that that sort of large effect mutation generated by loss of molecular function in genes could play a role in evolution in the wild as opposed to the laboratory where there's very strong unidirectional pressure and we're sort of cosseting the organisms? And so here at least is an argument in favor of that proposition. Okay, so this is a classical diagram of the sort popularized by Sewell Wright, and there have been, I guess Dave Waite showed a very nice computer version of a landscape like this. This is sort of the simplified one. So there are two axes that define the genotype. Obviously, that's a gross and pathetic simplification, but it helps humans because we only see in three dimensions. And the z-axis is fitness. Okay, what Fisher and people pointed out is if this is as fit as you can be in some environment, typically organisms end up somewhere around and a little bit above and below this red line where there is a balance between selection and mutation. So if you're at the top, all mutations can do is drag you down, and so there's a mutation selection balance, you're somewhere up this peak. Okay? And a small mutation could take you further up. A large effect mutation could take you to some other hillock. Okay? If you believe Fisher's geometrical argument, it's liable to take you a fair ways down the height of that hillock because there's a larger cross-sectional area here. And this is clearly a bad thing to do anyway because this peak is not nearly as high as this one, okay? But it could be true that this genotype in a different niche, which is yellow, puts you on the same hillock, but in that environment, the absolute fitness at the top of the peak is much higher, okay? And so the argument is that if you are in a crowded ecosystem, so think Amazonian rainforest or Pacific Northwest kelp forest, where it's rich and mature and there are many species and each niche is occupied, when you get here, you will be a little bit like Goldilocks. You will be in someone else's niche, okay? If it's occupied, the chances are whoever lives here has a fitness that's higher than yours. You will be outcompeted and extinguished, and that mutant will have been a hopeless monster, right? Could in principle have occupied the niche, but someone else is already there and better adapted. And the argument is that if you are somewhere like a brand new Hawaiian island or land as it first pops out of the surface of the seas on Earth much longer ago, the ecosystem might be virgin and no one is present in this niche. Okay? And if that's true, the mutant will survive as long as its absolute fitness is greater than one if you're a haploid, two if you're sexually reproducing diploid. Okay? And so now maybe the mutant is a hopeful monster. Okay? And so the argument is that if you want large effect mutations, those may be quite hard to get, as in very small target size, by making mutations that improve the molecular function of particular proteins or RNA. They may be quite easy to get by killing genes because it perturbs the genetic architecture and cells or organisms start to do different things. And now, if you're in one of these virgin ecosystems, all you have to do is climb up the peak. And you could climb up the peak in principle by making what a geneticist would call suppressor mutations, which ameliorate whatever the bad effects of this mutation, this first mutation were, and preserve the good ones. Right, and potentially even after you've gone a long way up, you could even revert the original mutation and restore the function of the gene. Right, so one of the things that we're interested in but have made absolutely no progress on is trying to think about what could you do to look at places where evolution is occurring rapidly to see if anything like this might have gone on, okay? Which again means going back and finding ways to make good inferences from sequence evolution. Okay, so now on to experiments. Okay, so why do we do this in yeast? Has anyone talked about yeast so far? Okay. Yes? No? Oh, yes, Sasha did. Excuse me, Sasha. All right. So yeast grows fast, can be made to proliferate sexually or asexually, so I'll show you the life cycle in a second, has excellent genetics. There is an argument now that in some ways genetics in yeast is better than it is in E. coli and other bacteria, and we could debate that. We wanted to. There are genome-based tools to find mutations. In particular, as I'll explain, finding the causative mutations in evolution experiments, it's really useful to have sex. And at least to a reductionist, it can be multicellular. And in the longer version of this talk, which I'm trying to avoid giving, there's an argument, there's a slide about why reductionism is good, but we'll assume that we're amongst friendly reductionists. Okay. So this is the life cycle of budding yeast. It exists as two haploid forms. They don't have sex chromosomes. There's a single locus that differs between the two mating types or sexes. They divide by making these little buds. When it gets bigger, it buds off with a nucleus. There's A. There's alpha. These two cells cell types can talk to each other by secreting pheromones. And when they do, the cells can't move, but they can grow preferentially towards each other. These guys touch at their tips, they fuse, their nuclei fuse, so now this is a diploid nucleus. It can divide exactly the same way. So both of these cycles can be repeated ad nauseum, although in the wild, yeast are like us in the haploid phase of their life cycle, probably only last one generation. In the laboratory, typically, most geneticists are passaging haploids at any given moment, but that's not a reflection of the natural world. If you starve these cells in the correct way, they go through meiosis, they make four spores, two are A and two are alpha, And in the wild, yeast works on the principle that vice is nice, but incest is best. And as these A's and alphas germinate, they mate with each other to recreate the diploid. Okay? So they often don't go through this cycle in the wild. But if you do it in the lab and you separate the spores so they can't mate from each other, they germinate and they go back. And so in terms of developmental biology, this change in response to an external signal of the behavior of the cells could be thought of as differentiation, as could this change in habit and morphology as these guys go through meiosis and make spores. These cells, the diploid and haploid cells, are determined by their genotypes to behave in different ways to different signals. So that's an example of what developmental biologists call determination. The ability of different cells to behave differently in response to the same signals. So these guys are determined if they're starved to sporulate, whereas these guys are not. And last but not least, there is cell-cell communication and cell-cell interaction here. So you could argue that there's nothing you want to study in developmental biology that is not exhibited by this humble organism. Okay. So the next thing to tell you about is that just like dogs, yeast have been tamed. This is a line picture, but it's not really useful to, or there isn't an informative picture. You should not conclude that this white stuff on the surface of the grapes is yeast, because actually the yeast you find in vineyards is inside damaged grapes, where it has probably been introduced by the biting mouth parts of large insects. But nevertheless, it was originally isolated from things like this and rotting fruit, and it was domesticated, and the pioneers of yeast geneticists like Robert Mortimer bred yeast in the lab to have properties that were useful to them. For example, like swimming, not swimming, they can't swim, but floating around as single cells rather than as clumps of cells, okay? But in fact, many of the natural isolates instead grow as these lineage-based multicellular clumps, and they grow like that because the cytoplasm of the cells divides. They do cytokinesis, but they are still connected by a common cell wall. In laboratory strains, that place of common connection is dissolved by enzymes that the bud secretes, and the cells float apart. But in many, not all, strains you find in the wild, that's not true. And so Leonid Krugliak and his colleagues crossed together a wild strain and a laboratory strain, and they investigated the segregation of different traits, and by doing careful genetic mapping, they showed that the strain background we use, which is called W303, has a mutation in a gene called AMN1. So this is the yeast that we know and love in my lab and in many others. This is exactly the same yeast, but with the allele of this gene that comes from a wild strain called Robert Mortimer 11 reintroduced, and you can see now that the cells grow as clumps. So we can make two cell populations that are genetically identical except for this one locus, and therefore grow either as clumps or as single cells. So we can investigate what this does or does not buy you. Okay? So this is just a cartoon. These are different forms of multicellularity. That's none. That's strains as they've been domesticated. They just divide. This is what I just showed you on the slide. So these are lineage-based clumps, because the reason the clumps form is because cells fail to let go of their daughters. So if you like, this is the sort of Jerry Springer family where kids go to college and never leave the home. And this is a different form of multicellularity. This is what is called flocculation. It's important in the brewing industry. And what this means is that individual cells are sticky. So in principle, they could come from different lineages, red and yellow. And when they bump into each other, they stick together. So this is not a lineage-restricted clump. And you could worry, if you wished, about the interactions between different genotypes here and what that all meant. And if you wish, mention deeply divisive words like cheating and cooperation and stuff. Okay. So why should you be multicellular? So one reason is to avoid being lunch. So these are yeast. This is the world's smallest fish. This is a cartoon. Fish can eat yeast. If the yeast stuck together to make clumps, clump is too big for fish to eat. Fish dies. Okay? And so it's actually an experiment like this. Boris et al. In this paper took an alga and they evolved it with a predator, a ciliated protozoan that would swim around and eat the algae. And the algae evolved to do exactly this because now they're too big to get eaten. So here's a second reason for being multicellular. And this is to utilize public goods. So I'm going to give you a particular example. And so here is a complex nutrient made of polymerized black balls. Okay? And this is the black ball hydrolase. Okay? If the polymeric black balls are too large to import into the cell, the hydrolase has to be outside the cell. So it could be secreted into the medium. In the case that I'm going to discuss of yeast, it's lodged within the cell wall. So the cell wall in yeast is about 100 nanometers thick. It is a cross-linked mess, largely of polysaccharides. It has a pore size that allows things that are smaller than about 50 kilodaltons to float in and out. Okay, but if this protein is bigger, it's going to be lodged there. It will have access to this complex nutrient. It will hydrolyze it to a simple form that cells can import. So here's the black ball importer. But if you consider the physics of diffusion, better than 99% of it is just going to float off into space. Okay? And so if you were a single cell in an infinite sink, most of the stuff that you hydrolyze floats away and is never seen by you again. And so here is that single cell. Here is the gradient of black balls, unfortunately rendered in red, that goes down as 1 over r away from the cell. If you don't believe it's 1 over r, you can consult Howard Berg's beautiful little book on diffusion where the math is. And if this concentration is too low to sustain the growth of that cell, in other words, it can't import enough of the stuff before it diffuses away, this cell is not going to grow or prosper. But if 6 of those cells are stuck together, they're each hydrolyzing at the same rate, and this cell at the center gets 1% of the hydrolysis products it makes, but also 1% of these other 6 cells here, so it's being fed 7 times as well, and perhaps it can grow. Okay? So this could be one argument for evolving some form of primitive undifferentiated multicellularity. Okay? The other reason, which we'll come back to at the end if we get there, has to do with holding off freeloaders. So imagine here is mixed society, and let's, for the sake of argument, imagine that the yellow cells are like the cells that were on the previous slide. They're hydrolyzing some object or some chemical compound in the environment to release some nutrient which everyone can use. Okay, and if the density is high enough, we don't really have to worry too much about this floating away problem. And now let us imagine that the red cells are avoiding the cost of making the enzymes that release the public good, but are profiting by the public good that is being produced by these other guys. So these guys, in principle, are paying less, and they would have an advantage. There's all sorts of complications about this. I think we overemphasize worries about cheating in evolution because of its anthropomorphic connection. And obviously, if these cells fall to very low density, these guys are much worse off than these guys, and so it's probably good not to get too way excited about it and to believe with Abe Lincoln that you can fool all of the people some of the time and some of the people all of the time, but you can't really cheat everyone else all of the time. There are costs and benefits to strategies like this. It's not just beneficial. Okay? But if you wanted to avoid the problem, especially if these guys, the red guys, stick to the black guys, and we have, I think, did we bring the sticky strains? John, sticky strains?
I think so. I wouldn't call them.
Okay. So we brought strains that have been engineered to stick to and try and leech off other people, okay, that could potentially be played with in the next couple of weeks. But one way of avoiding that is if your multicellularity, instead of occurring by aggregation as it did here, occurs by clonal growth. Even if you don't go through single cell propagules, as long as the clumps break up from time to time, it is guaranteed that eventually the red guys are in one clump and the yellow guys or in another, and in the sort of thing that I was showing you in the previous slide, where things diffuse away, there's an advantage to being closer to the source, which these guys are, rather than further away, which these guys are. Okay. So the first thing I'm going to talk about, after an endless introduction, is that multicellularity can improve access to some nutrients. So here are two people. This is John Koshwinez, who did all the experiments and the analysis, who was a postdoctoral fellow in the lab and now works as a research scientist at the Novartis Institute for Biomedical Research in Cambridge. And this is Kevin Foster, who is a Bauer Fellow at Harvard and is a properly trained evolutionary biologist, so he can tell John and I when we're thinking in stupid ways. And so he was a large part of the intellectual background and impetus for the work I'm about to describe. They are seen here in an apple orchard in western Massachusetts catching insects to see if there is live culturable yeast in the guts of these insects, which have been feeding on rotting apples, which is one of the places that yeast live, because that's how you make hard cider. Okay, so going back to the public goods model, we're now going to use something less hypothetical than polymeric black balls. This is sucrose, the thing you put in your coffee at KITP. It is a disaccharide composed of one glucose and one fructose molecule linked together by an oxygen atom. This enzyme called invertase, which has a long and glorious history in the history of biology, is lodged in the cell wall. It's the product of the SUC2 gene. It hydrolyzes sucrose to one molecule of glucose and one molecule of fructose. Most of it floats away, but a small fraction of it can be captured by one of 17 different hexose transporters that yeast expresses to import molecules like glucose and fructose, which it can then do glycolysis on and live and be happy and produce beer and wine and bread for us. Okay? And so what John, who comes from an engineering background, wanted to do was to ask, is it really true that making clumps of cells here could help cells grow at very low density and in very low sucrose concentrations? And so he, being an engineer, he does not like free parameters, and so he culled parameters that have been experimentally measured from the literature, measured a few that were either not yet measured or where he wasn't happy about the accuracy of the values, and he made a prediction from free parameter-free simulations. Okay, and that prediction is quite simple. It is that single cells can't, at least can't quickly, form colonies at low sucrose concentrations and low cell concentrations, whereas clumps of cells can. Okay, but it is also true that engineers have calculated that bumblebees can't fly. And so an experiment is in order, and so here is the experiment. So we take a microtiter well, which is just a geometric array of tiny little test tubes.
Andrew, can you say the prediction again?
Yes.
With a different set of words?
Sure.
It's not quite tracking.
I'll show you the prediction on this slide. It's actually easier to say it here. Okay? So here are 30 individual cells that can make invertase. So this means the wild type gene. This is a control where we've knocked out the invertase gene because if things grow here on sucrose, something is badly wrong. Okay, so using a fluorescence-activated cell sorter, we can actually put counted numbers of cells in one of these wells. And so this is 30 wild-type cells. Okay, using that mutation that we reintroduced from wild strains, John can grow things so they make clumps. You can use information from the fax machine and then take the clumps you've sorted and look at them under the microscope and adjust everything so you're making clumps between 15 and 30 cells. Okay?
Why choose that number?
Because that's what theory suggests is, or the simulation suggests is a good size to get the difference between the behavior of clumps and single cells. Right? Eventually, as the clumps get too big, if they're hydrolyzing stuff as it diffuses through, things in the middle will be starved. And they're also, it also just gets easier to estimate their size in this range than if they were 1,000. So John and Max Lavrentovich and David Nelson, the latter two being theorists, have done calculations and experiments to ask how big a clump would have to get before guys in the middle were starved. It's sort of on the order of 1,000 cells, so we're well below that limit here.
So just to understand,
you're making them, the clumps, the right size by selecting them in the packs?
So in the slide that I showed you, there was a heterogeneous distribution of sizes of clumps. So the things that we have brought that people can play with, one of the things we're interested in is like what controls that distribution and why is it different in different strains that have been evolved, which I'll get to in a second. And, you know, could you make models that would make predictions and do tests and so on and so forth. And so we take a very heterogeneous range of clump sizes and we pick a narrow sliver by fiat and machine. Okay? Just to test this hypothesis. Okay? So these guys get a single clump, which is actually in general less cells than are being deposited here. And again, these are mutants which can't make invertase, so nothing better happened here. So here's the experiment. So this was 30 cells with invertase, 30 cells without invertase, one clump with invertase, one clump without invertase. This is 8 millimolar sucrose. And you can see you get growth here. So these are tens of thousands of cells here. And nothing much yet has happened here. And there's a control where we do exactly the same experiment, but we put them into 8 millimolar fructose plus 8 millimolar glucose, which is what you get if you hydrolyze this. And now you can see a whole bunch of little spots down in this column, a whole bunch of little spots down in this column, which is little colonies grown from single cells. And these clumps grow too. And I just didn't show it to try and make things faster. Okay. So what John did is to engineer three different ways that cells could grow in low sucrose concentrations. So I just showed you one. You can bump up artificially the production of invertase. So now at low sucrose concentrations, you're not importing a higher fraction of the glucose and fructose that you make, but you're making glucose and fructose at a higher rate. So that same low fraction of a higher rate is now enough to get you to grow. And you can trick the cells by genetic construction so that instead of doing the hydrolysis on the outside, they import the sucrose, actually by hijacking an importer that is normally used to import the disaccharide maltose, which is how you make beer rather than wine. And now you hydrolyze it inside the cell because you make invertase inside the cell. Okay? And this works. This raises an obvious question of why are they doing it in such an ass backwards way, which we can talk about if people want. Okay? So by engineering, all of these solutions work and work fairly well. And so John did this experiment, which he dubbed WWED, what would evolution do? And so the idea is you take cells at low density, you allow them to proliferate, you hope that mutants that do better arise, you dilute them back. Obviously, if this was properly animated, the mutant cell would make it through the dilution because otherwise this is pretty useless, but you get the idea. Okay? And we just go round and round and round. Okay? So what John actually did was to inoculate 500,000 cells into 50 mils of 1 millimolar sucrose. This for yeast, so this is 10,000 cells per mil, is actually by laboratory standards a low cell density. Okay? He allows them to grow to high density. So at the beginning of this experiment, this takes an unconscionably long time. So it takes about 2 weeks instead of a day, which is what would normally happen if you were doing this in glucose. When something has grown, you wash them, you count them, you re-inoculate, and and this is the other important point. One of the great glories of our organism is it can be frozen and thawed, and when it is thawed, it comes back to life. For those who work on Drosophila, it can be frozen, it can be thawed, but the last part, the coming back to life part, is missing. Okay? Which is why, like, Boris has a little bench in his lab where there are all these fly vials which have to be continually propagated by people transferring flies. Okay, so John went around this loop about 30 times. And so what happened in 11 out of 12 independent runs is that these populations evolved multicellularity. So this is just a rogues gallery of three of them. Okay? And you'll see that they're very different forms of this. Some of these guys make you wonder if the distribution of clump sizes is tighter than you would expect if there was purely random fragmentation of clumps. So the simplest model you can possibly make is that cells divide, the mother is held onto the daughter, and there is some constant probability per unit time that one of those linkages is broken. I think intuitively you can see that that should give you a distribution with a ridiculously long tail. Doesn't really look like these guys come from such a distribution, but it's an interesting thing that students could investigate. This looks much more like you would expect that to look like, and these are Mondo. Okay, these are macroscopically just visible objects. Okay, and coming back to the question that Jamie asked before, this is certainly approaching the limit where the cells in the middle might be starved, and it is certainly at the limit where the cells in the middle will be experiencing a different environment than the cells on the outside. And you might imagine that if you propagated a culture like this long enough, the cells would start genetically to evolve programs so that these cells responded optimally to whatever that environment was, and you might get the beginnings of differentiation within clumps like this. And maybe, again, speculation, this is what something like this happened in the evolution of what? All right. Yes?
Sorry. What were the scale bars on the lower image?
The scale bars are the same. Okay. And I'm sorry that the, well, well, these two are obviously. We're going to test, let's hope that. They're not quite the same. They're on the same order. Okay. And there's a picture in the paper which is done properly, and I can give you the link to the paper. What you can see is, like, here's a single cell, right? And this is a single cell plopping off a cell here. So they're on the order of the same size. Thank you. Yes. These are lineage-based clumps, right? So they're not, the cells aren't sticky. And there's a reason for, I think, for understanding why we evolved that in this experiment, which is that initially any mutant allele is going to be at low frequency. And so if you have something that's sticky at low frequency, this is not necessarily very helpful because the chance of running into someone else who's sticky is quite small, and so your selective advantage is going to be frequency dependent in a way that hurts you because it's actually going to be very low when your frequency is low. Whereas if you just let go of your, fail to let go of your daughters, you don't have to worry about those density effects. So that's why we think this is the form that we evolved here. Yes?
In how many of your evolved population do you observe lonely cells, so cells that remain outside your flocks?
We'd have to look at the pictures in the paper. I just don't remember. Okay. These are the two biggest ones. These two are supposed to be sort of representative of the 11 lineages that form some form of multicellular, but I can't remember details. Okay. So one of the things that I should have, yes?
When you do the washing and redilution, do these clumps get, do they get broken up into single cells,
no,
or do they get?
No. They get propagated as clumps. I mean, the big ones may break a little, but there's certainly no, the attempt is as much as possible to leave them undisturbed.
Did the 12th lineage find another solution?
Yeah, there's one lineage that did this as single cells, okay? And we know what the mutations are, but we don't really understand exactly, in a physiological sense, how they did it. So, you know, in the WWED sense, the results are 11-1, evolve multicellularity, one do something else, which is single cells. So they can either have figured out how to import sucrose, or they're just hydrolyzing it more efficiently, or capturing the hydrolysis products more efficiently. And like I said, although we know what the causative mutations are, as I'm going to explain in a second, this often doesn't give you a very good clue as to what had happened. Nah, that's a good question, and we talked a lot about doing it, and we were enthusiastic about doing it, but we're lazy bastards, and we haven't done it. No, but it's a really good experiment, and in particular, like, are these guys really too big? Yeah, it's a great experiment. We could do it here.
Yeah, you can do it here.
So one of the things that I didn't tell you was that to make all this happen faster, we elevate the mutation rate by a factor of about 100. So DNA polymerases go along and they put bases in one at a time, and after every base they've checked whether they've put the right base in, and if they haven't, they excise the base they just put in. It's called proofreading activity. Okay? And so if you go to the literature, you can find people who have labored hard to make very nice mutants that kill the proofreading activity but leave the enzyme capable of incorporating itself into replication forks and the like. And that elevates the mutation frequency by about a factor of 100. So in our experiments, the cells mutate roughly one base pair per cell division. Okay? So if you do an experiment which is run, actually it's probably more like half a base pair per cell division, or one every two. If you do an experiment that's run for 400 generations, you're going to have about 200 mutations in the genome, and the expectation is the vast majority of those are just random, neutral, or very mildly deleterious garbage which just hitchhiked with the advantageous mutation. So we have to sort out who is who. And this is where sex is useful. So here is an evolved strain. I'm showing there being four chromosomes. Yeast really has 16. Three of the mutations are green, which means neutral, and one which is red, which is a causal mutation. It somehow gives rise to the phenotype. So we cross it to its ancestor, or opposite mating type version of ancestor. We isolate lots and lots of haploid products after we've gone through meiosis, and we now select for those ones and only those ones which have the selected phenotype. So if you imagine having done that, to have the selected phenotype, you must have the red mutation. Okay? For all this garbage, there's a 50-50 chance that an individual spore gets the green allele or the ancestral allele. So we take this big thing, this pool of spores, we make DNA from it, we do next generation sequencing at high coverage, and we just count allele frequencies at every locus. So the prediction is if it's a causative allele, it should be a frequency of at least 90%. And if it's neutral, it should be some statistical distribution around 50. Okay? And so this works, and actually, I'll say one other thing. And then we go back, which I'm not going to show you for John's experiment. And having identified these guys, which are putative causal mutations, we re-engineer these mutations into the ancestral strain using the tricks of the trade of yeast genetics, which is sort of slow and painful, but can be done. And then we show that the reconstructed strain has, as closely as we can measure, the property of the evolved strain, which means that we know that the causal mutations at least lie amongst these guys. These guys are at least sufficient. Okay, so John looked at 12 different lineages. 47 genes have been mutated to change their amino acid sequence. Some genes got mutated many times. This gene has a known role in the program that is involved in separating the cells after the cytoplasm has divided and getting rid of the joining cell wall, so it is not in the least surprising we get mutations that kill this gene in 7 out of 12 lineages. This is involved in something completely different. We have not the faintest idea of why we get this mutation. We pay money to people who make suggestions that turn out to be right for any of these things. I'm serious. Six-pack of beer for any suggestion to explain a connection that we don't understand. Okay? 8 genes got mutated in 2 of the lineages, 3 genes got mutated in 3 of the lineages, but 34 of them only got mutated in 1 of the trials. Okay? 3 pathways got frequently mutated, so as well as looking at individual genes, they're genetic pathways. You can ask, okay, well, don't worry about the individual gene. Is it in the same pathway? And the 3 pathways that frequently got mutated are something called catabolite repression. Yeast loves to grow on glucose, and when it grows on glucose, it shuts down genes that enable cells to grow on alternative, crappier carbon sources. And so 8 of the 12 clones have mutations that inactivate some part of the catabolite repression pathway. There's this horrible thing called the mediator complex that you really don't even want to ask about. It's involved in the nastiness and mysteries of eukaryotic transcription. People can't even agree on how many components it has, but we do get mutations in it. Okay? And the last thing, which actually appeared on a slide of Sasha's too, is when he was looking at all the mutations in the clones they had that had taken the first step to doing better on low glucose, are involved in growth control via controlling the concentration of cyclic AMP and cyclic AMP dependent protein kinase activity and RAS and stuff like that. And we think we understand, and we have some very weak experimental evidence about why these guys got selected.
And that's according to the
catabolite repression? Yeah, the catabolite repression is about gene expression. This, we think, is about cells, when cells make the decision that the nutrient levels have gotten so low that it is more sane to stop in G1 and not try and execute another cell cycle or gamble and go forwards. And what we think is that these mutations are encouraging them to gamble, and because John came back and regularly refed them, that turned out to be a good gamble. It's, I mean, I suggested the same explanation for the socialist stuff.
So, Andrew?
Yes?
If you took a composite sugar that doesn't have two components, but the same component twice, like if you have a little sugar?
Maltose.
So, this, and okay, and you knock out everything that can take it in, you know, inside immediately, blah, blah. Then the first mutant is 8 out of 12 should not be there, right? So we have now only one sugar, right?
I don't know.
So I'm wondering whether they are switching from glucose to fructose. And that's
yeah, it's an interesting question as to whether this is helping them with the fructose. The reality is that fructose really acts a lot. So in the pathway of glycolysis, you make glucose 6-phosphate, and then you isomerize it to make fructose 6-phosphate, and then you phosphorylate the fructose to make fructose 1,6-diphosphate. And so actually, fructose in some senses is almost as good as glucose. So I don't think catabolite derepression, it's much more for things like galactose and stuff like that. Yes?
I noticed that the morphology of the yeast are pretty screwed up in your pictures. They're pretty variable. And I'm wondering if you can look at that, like the variability. I mean, because I know that mutations in the mediator complex tend to increase cell-to-cell variability.
That's a good point, and it's something that's worth looking at. So one of the Mondo clump that was down here is actually showing pseudo-hyphal growth, and so exactly why that's true. And so I guess what I would say is you have a sharp eye. Some of those things, there are some weird-looking cells. Some of the lineages, the things look very normal, but it was actually an interesting thing we could easily do here is, like, we know which are which, and we could see if there's a correlation. Thanks. Yes?
Do you see here that there is some interment in cell division from some of these mutations?
So
you said clonally, no?
Yeah, everyone's doing cytokinesis normally, so the cytoplasm of the cells are becoming separate. The impairment is in the separation of the cell wall that joins the mother to the daughter. Right, so that's exactly how we think these clumps are arising, right? And for example, this gene has a well-known role in the transcriptional pathway that induces the expression in daughter cells of the glucanase hydrolyzing enzymes and chitinase, which is going to dissolve the common cell wall that holds the mother and daughter together. So yes, absolutely. Yes?
So not just the ACE2 mutations, but all the mutations that you find are all loss of function?
Okay, so we don't know that. So there are mutations that are stop codons relatively early in open reading frames. You know, I will invite lightning to vaporize me if those are not loss of function mutations, right? We know from experiments where we have heavily mutagenized individual genes and then sequenced them that about a third of the strong loss of function mutations are the creation of nonsense codons in genes. In all the mutations that John found in this study, about a third of them are nonsense mutations. Okay? So statistically, that suggests that the substantial majority of the rest of them are loss of function mutations. We do not know on a gene by gene basis. So here's what I will say. There is nothing we have found yet that we have ever shown to be a gain of function mutation. That doesn't mean there can't be any. It just means that the statistical evidence suggests that the strong majority of them are loss of function and probably strong loss of function. And unfortunately, that often means that we know less about the molecular basis of the phenotype than we were hoping to, right? And particularly when there's relatively little commonality between what we see. And what I would say is of all these 47 genes, if we look at those genes and put on our, you know, yeast geneticist and cell biologist hat, for about a third of them, we can make a relatively plausible argument about why we selected mutations in these genes, like some of these things down here. For about another third, if you sit in a driveway and smoke crack for a while, you can come up with something that, you know, you could try and convince someone, but it's almost surely wrong. And for a third of them, we just have no idea whatsoever. Okay? And it's an indication that, you know, this is, you know, certainly this is the best studied genetically and cell biologically eukaryote on the face of the planet. And, you know, you could get yeast geneticists to tell you that we understand a lot about how yeast works. And experiments like this reveal how little we actually understand. Okay. So I told you that you can reconstruct things. You can engineer in evolved alleles. You can also engineer out the evolved alleles and recreate the ancestral phenotype. Okay? So one clone has an interesting property that it has something that we did not select for, but which could under other circumstances be useful. So Stephen Jay Gould made this argument that, and Richard Lewontin, that this would happen in evolution. And they use the phrase spandrel, so this is some Italian Renaissance structure. This is structural, this is load-bearing, this is load-transferring, this arch here. You don't need anything here. You could leave this empty, but artists and stonemasons had to be fully employed, and so you make these beautiful panels here. So that's a spandrel is the architectural term. And so the idea, as originally enunciated by Gould and Lewontin, is perhaps there are things like this that got put in sort of by accident along the way and can be useful. And so all I'm going to tell you is that one of John's clones has the property that when you grow it in 1 millimolar sucrose, it grows these big clumps. And when you grow it in 1 millimolar glucose and 1 millimolar fructose, it grows as much smaller clumps. And in terms of dispersal and regulated life cycle, this is an interesting thing to fiddle with. Okay. So as I mentioned, there is this question about why should yeast hydrolyze sucrose on the outside anyway, given that this is sort of inefficient. And there are two possible answers we could talk about over beer. All right. How long can I keep talking for, Richard?
Maybe 20 minutes, half an hour.
Okay.
Can I ask a question about the first break?
Yeah.
How does the breakup work?
No idea. The head of the clumps break?
Yeah.
I have no idea. That's why we're here. Because there are smart people here who want to play. We just
have to look.
Yeah, we just have to look. That's why we're here.
You must have looked.
We haven't. I mean, we've just been too busy doing other things, and John is now off in another life, and we're sort of looking for the next John and stuff like that. No, we really haven't looked, okay? We haven't made movies. It's on the list, but we haven't done it. No, I'm not being coy. Okay. So I guess we're going to go much faster now. Okay, evolution, there is an argument. If you, like John Hopfield, define computation as the rule-based transformation of symbols, one sort into another, I think much of evolution is a selection for computation, at least on this basis. That is, making computations on your environment, in particular what your environment might do in the future, and so on and so forth. Here is an example of computation. Both of these phrases mean to leave somewhere without asking permission first. And it's a reflection of the affectionate but competitive relationship that the French and English have had for many years. Okay. So, organisms are selected to predict and prepare for the future. This is Ted Williams, the splendid splinter, who was able to hit baseballs and put them places where fielders couldn't reach them 40% of the time in one particular year. And this is prediction because he and any other baseball player has to decide when and where to swing at the ball when it is only one third of the distance between the pitcher and the batter because of the time delays in the human nervous system, okay? Which is why it's hard to do. This is Harrison's H1 chronometer, which enabled the British Navy to know its latitude accurately. And this is bacteriophage lambda that somehow knows whether one lambda phage has gone into a cell or two. Because the fraction of the E. coli cells that lyse when you have one phage per cell is high, and the fraction where the lambda goes into the genome and hides out to wait for different times is high when two go in. Okay? As Philippe Kurilski showed, and a bunch of, I mean, it's an interesting question of how you can count in the presence of all the molecular noise that various physics types people are now interested in on the basis of this finding. Okay? These are other people who've talked about the importance of prediction. Okay? And the one thing that it's easy to convince people about that organisms make predictions is the circadian clock. Like, your blood pressure and body temperature reached a minimum at 3 o'clock this morning and it will reach a maximum sometime this afternoon. And it would keep doing that even if we kept you in constant light. I mean, the period for most people is not exactly 24 hours, but you'd continue to see that regular oscillation if you lived in constant light. Okay? So what Greg did is he's going to select to try and create something that looks like a circadian clock in budding yeast. He's going to put yellow fluorescent protein under the control of a promoter. As it turns out, we can call this a random yeast promoter. He is going to select for the cells to be dim in the morning using a fluorescence-activated cell sorter. So he just tells the machine, tell me how bright every cell is, take the dimmest 6%. In the evening, he's going to take the brightest 6%, rinse and repeat. Okay. So the strain has the promoter of a gene that was previously been shown by Jerry Fink's lab to show epigenetic variation driving this version of a yellowish protein. This is the genetic nomenclature for our mutator that elevates the mutation frequency. And so this is just the selection diagram again. Okay? So the expectation is we are trying to encourage the cells to alter their program of gene expression so that in the morning this gene is weakly expressed and in the evening it is strongly expressed. So this is what the profiles actually look like. This is the ancestor in the morning and the evening. Looks about the same. This is after 30 rounds of evolution. So the black is just this trace. Again, the red is what they looked like after 30 cycles of evolution. And there's this little shoulder here. Okay, so something has changed. They're a little brighter in the evening. It turns out that if you take clones from that population, the difference between the morning and the evening is quite pronounced. But it kept being this bimodal distribution. You might have expected if you keep selecting, you just get this behavior in the evening. And so at a certain point, Greg looked at the cells. This is what they look like in the morning. This is what they look like in the evening. These cells are sticky, okay? And they show regulated stickiness. They're sticky as they grow during the day and they become unsticky at night. And so this is an example of the cells doing something different from what we expected them to do. We wanted them to change gene expression. The rate at which they express the fluorescent protein per cell is exactly the same in the morning and in the evening, but the fax machine doesn't know that these are clumps of cells instead of single cells. Okay. Okay. This is what the distribution of the number of cells per clumps look like in the morning and the evening. So I have to say something important here. The way we keep these cells synchronized is by doing the selection that I showed you. We take the dimmest 6% in the morning, the brightest 6% in the evening. If we freeze the cells down and then revive them and we look at them, they look like a mixture of these two populations. That is that the different cells in the population appear to have lost synchrony with each other. Okay? Yes?
Just, I'm not familiar with these at all, so is there any existing 24-hour cyclic behavior in yeast?
There is no convincing evidence for any existing behavior, but it's a possibility that absolutely cannot be excluded. Right?
Okay.
So we could have built a connection to a pre-existing clock.
Because maybe, I mean, if there was no ability for it to do some sort of 24-hour cycle already, surely you're selected with broader noise in the expression of this.
Well, I mean, what we get is, like, if we stop doing the selection, at least for a while, the things keep going up and down.
So if you do this with other periods?
We haven't done it with other periods. So you could do the selection with different periods, but we have not.
And Andrew, I'm sorry, but while you're stopped, what was the significance of the fact that the promoter driving the first and first?
None. Because of what we evolved, which is just changes in,
yeah.
Absolutely none. We just were expecting to get one thing and got something else.
Okay.
So if we take the population that comes out of the freezer, which is mixed up, and we propagate it exactly the same way, so this sort of has to do with your question. So now we send them through the fax machine, but we don't select. We just take everyone who comes through, and we look in morning and evening. These distributions are the same. So it's not that the cells are responding to some variable in the laboratory that's going up and down every 24 hours, and we just don't know what it is, right? Like whether the red line is rumbling underneath the building or not. Okay? So the experiment you can do, which Greg did, is you take cells in the morning when they are single cells, by and large. You fluorescently label the cells by chemically labeling them, not with a fluorescent protein. And you watch them as they grow during the day. And their daughters, who are unlabeled, so this should be clear rather than green, stick to them. And because they keep doing that, you build clones. When you get to the evening, you can take a population, and now you label the whole population with your fluorescent dye. And you take samples during the night. And what you see during the night is that these clumps give rise to some cells that float away. It's also true that the clumps become smaller. And as long as these cells are dividing, even if they didn't, the clumps are going to get diluted out. And so in the morning, the population is largely single cells.
What's the time difference between the morning run and the evening run?
Well, I mean, this is a 24-hour cycle. This transition occurs at 10 hours. So this is morning, this is evening. So it's not exactly 12 hours, because like Greg likes to go home and see his family and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, is it possible that they naturally clump up after 10 hours, but then if you wait for another 4 hours, they just unclump? And so you've accidentally found a timing where you discover this, a sort of behavior of clumping.
Well, but then they have to naturally start clumping again after another 14.
Well, I'm thinking that if you take the clumps at 10 hours and maybe 4 hours later they've dispersed, but you put them in new media.
The transfer regime. What about that?
Well, they get. You can not transfer them to new media here, and this still happens. Okay. This also happens at approximately infinite dilution, like at 10 to the 4 cells per mil, which is way below the concentration where there could be any sort of chemical mediated communication between the cells. Okay. So as far as we can tell, there is some sort of internal timing mechanism so that cells start in this state, they stay sticky they and their descendants stay sticky. And then at a certain point, their stickiness declines. And as a result of that, they give rise to single cells, and probably because some of the cells within the clump, because you're giving birth to new cells within the clump, some of those cells are not sticky, the thing breaks up. I mean, one of the things that's worth pointing out is that they can't be very sticky because it turns out that the daughters stick to the cells who are their mothers, not other cells in the population. So that even though these clumps arise by stickiness, they're basically lineage restricted. Right? And if the cells were wildly sticky, the whole same law, or to just crash into each other and stick, which it doesn't.
So this cycle you presented here is for just like one growth. You never dilute during the cycle you're showing. So the cell number is increasing.
The cell number is increasing both here and here. Right. And the cell densities, the total cell densities here and here, are as close as we can make them the same.
So you can't be a response to available nutrition.
Right, and that's one of the reasons why we did this at ridiculously low cell density, because there's no way they can be running out of nutrients. So. Oh, this slide has appeared twice, so that makes it talk. Oh, am I going the wrong direction? Or there's an internal duplication, whatever. Okay, fine. So Greg isolated four clones from this population and identified the causative or the putative causative mutations exactly the way I described. For this set here, he put them back in and the recreated things cycle. Okay? And in the interest of time, this is evidence that that's true, but I'm not going to walk you through the graph because I want to talk about quickly two other things. So here are the mutations that are involved. This one here, the star and the star there, means that they are nonsense mutations. If you suggest an explanation for why these genes, which again are most likely loss of function mutations, can produce this oscillatory behavior, and we do experiments, and you're right, I give you $500. And I've gotten one email from someone who had a suggestion, but all right. Okay, so I'm very quickly going to talk about one other thing.
Sorry, can I ask?
Yes, of course.
Did you look at the RNA level?
We did, and so we took asynchronous populations and synchronized populations, and we harvested RNA, and we did RNA-seq. And we can, if there's someone here who wants to look at that data and see if they can see stuff in it that we can't see, we can bring the data to Santa Barbara. So what we looked is, we initially looked, and there are some differences between the synchronous and the asynchronous populations, but there's the asynchronous evolved guys and there's also the ancestral guys, so there are two other pairwise comparisons. The two other pairwise comparisons that ought not to produce interesting things give more significantly different genes. So right? But we're not very good at this, so I'm be totally up for people who are good at it, looking at the data. Okay, this is Mary Wall, who was a graduate student who just graduated. And she is interested in the question of how did differentiated multicellularity arise? And I'm going to use a very particular definition of differentiation here. And because if I don't, we'll have a long argument, and we can have arguments afterwards as much as I'm going to define, for the purposes of this part of the talk, as differentiation is the ability of one cell type to promote another cell type's growth and survival. Okay? And so the question is, how did this property arise? So here is ER life. It is unicellular and it is undifferentiated. So one pathway by which it could have arisen is you first evolve the sort of undifferentiated multicellularity that John evolved, and later different cells within these lineage-restricted aggregates start exhibiting different behavior. And for example, the yellow cells are helping the blue cells grow and survive. An alternative possibility is this behavior, the differentiation arose first, which means the yellow cells have to be helping the blue cells at a distance here, right? So we're presumably going to have to invoke some sort of public goods argument, like the sucrose business. And later, these guys learn to stick together, okay? Mary's experiments are going to argue that this pathway is less evolutionarily likely in the rigorous speculation world than this one, because this is going to be unstable to blue cells, which never give rise to the yellow cells, as long as the yellow cells divide more slowly. Okay? So what Mary wanted is irreversible differentiation. She wants to slow the growth of the somatic cells, that is the yellow cells in the last slide, and she needs those cells to help the germ cells. The germ cells are going to be red, the somatic cells are going to be yellow. These grow quickly. Occasionally they give rise to the yellow cells. The yellow cells grow more slowly, but they help the red cells. So that's what all the cells in your body are doing for your eggs or sperm, depending on which gender you are, right? In terms of evolution, we're nothing. The eggs and sperm are everything, like however smart we think we are. Okay, so the scheme she built for doing this uses recombination. So Sasha used the same enzymes, but he was putting things into genomes. We're taking them out. These are two sites for that this recombinase called CREAK and ACTON. In the germ cell form, you make RFP, you make a growth accelerator. This stops transcription, that stands for terminator. And when you do the excision, you've lost the growth accelerator and the capacity to make RFP, and now you make YFP, and you make invertase so you can hydrolyze sucrose. And the growth accelerator that we used is a mutant form of a ribosomal protein, L28, which makes cells resistant to cyclohexamide. Okay, and cyclohexamide is just a protein synthesis inhibitor. And so when we excise the growth accelerator, the somatic cells are going to grow slower in the presence of cyclohexamide. And one of the nice features, And the somatic cells are going to do work by hydrolyzing sucrose, and because glucose and fructose will diffuse away, they can help the germ cells. This is John again. So we want to regulate the rate at which everything happens, and so we used a system engineered by Lindstrom and Gotchling where the recombinase is transcribed only in the daughter cells. It is fused to an estrogen binding domain that keeps it inactive unless you add estrogen. Okay, so it could not win the Tour de France. And by adding graded concentrations of the inducer, you can get graded levels of activity of the recombinase. So this is what all this looks like, and these are the people who made it and very kindly gave it to us. And this just shows you that we have rather exquisite control of the rate at which we give rise to somatic cells. So conversion rate means probability that a germ cell will give rise to a somatic cell. And by regulating the concentration of cyclohexamide, we can regulate the relative growth rate of the somatic cells to the germ cells. And if you're a population geneticist, you could think of this as mutation, and this is selection. And so Mary, in collaboration again with Max Lavrentovich and David Nelson, is actually testing various models about mutation selection balance in structured and unstructured environments. Okay? So the hypothesis is that the level of cellularity represents the long-term, regulates the long-term evolutionary stability of different strategies. So I'm reminding you that germ cells are red, the somatic cells are yellow. If you're a unicellular, notice the quotation marks, a cheat arises. And it is a germ cell which has a mutation, so it never differentiates anymore. It is effectively going to grow faster because it never gives rise to slower dividing progeny. So this guy can grow faster than these guys, but it receives benefits from the yellow cells all the same. And this is the ultimate tragedy of the commons. Okay? By contrast, here's a multicellular version of the same thing. In this clump, a cell that cannot differentiate and therefore divides faster arises. Okay? Even if the clump breaks up rather than going through single cell propagules, eventually after it's broken up enough, it has to be the case that these non-differentiating cells are in their own clump. And if, because the somatic and germ cells are physically associated, the germ cells have preferential access to the public goods that are liberated here, because there's an unstirred layer within the clump and around it. If that preferential access is bigger than the reproductive advantage that these guys have, these guys should win out, or at least the thing will come to some, in principle, can come to some stable equilibrium. Okay? So that's the hypothesis. And so the hypothesis is evolving differentiation within multicellular camps is an evolutionarily more stable strategy than involving it in a population of cells floating around. And so Mary engineered things that can't give rise to somatic cells, so she just removed the recombinase. We can make multicellular versions by inhibiting cell separation. Actually, this is not the mutation she used. And we measure the fitness of the converting versus the cheating strain by just propagating the culture, and everyone has a different fluorescent marker, and we just look at their abundance over time. So we just measure classical evolutionary fitness. And so here, this is a somewhat complicated slide, so let me start at the bottom. These guys lack one of the enzymes that's required to digest the cell wall that hold mothers and daughters together, and so they make clumps. Okay? And you can show that switching occurs within clumps, and so there are clumps that have both somatic and germline cells in them. This is the same genotype but grown on glucose and fructose instead of sucrose, so there is no advantage now. The somatic cells no longer confer any help. And these are the versions that grow as single cells. These are different concentrations of estradiol. So as the estradiol concentration goes up, the steady state fraction of germ cells is going to go up. So what you see under these circumstances is what you'd expect. The higher you make the conversion rate, so it's higher going from here to here, the worse off the lineages that can give rise to somatic cells are relative to the ones that can't, because the higher the conversion rate, effectively the lower the net proliferation rate of the germ cells is. And that's true for these guys, whether they grow in sucrose or in glucose. So once you add guys who can't switch, these guys who are giving rise to cells that can help cells in the population are going to be selected against. The same is true for the clumps, as long as you grow them on glucose and fructose, because now the germ cells aren't helping anyone. But when you have clumps and you provide them with sucrose, the multicellular lineages which have differentiation actually win. Okay? And so this is the basis of the argument that at least in our laboratory conditions, this making clumps first and evolving differentiation second is a more evolutionarily stable strategy, and therefore the speculation is that it probably happened that way during the evolution of the Earth. And these again are the people who did the work. John did the evolution of growing better by using public goods, intellectual guidance from Kevin Foster, Greg did the clock, Mary did the last thing, and NIH provided the money. Thank you. And that's the only talk I've ever finished at KITP.
Any questions by the younger ones in the room?
So I'm just wondering if there's any public goods regime might still work without clumps. I mean, is it possible to envisage a setup where both cells are required to contribute or something, and therefore cheaters cannot prosper?
So, I guess what I would say is, just thinking about it quickly and naively, if they're helping each other by exchanging things through the medium, unless there's some very complicated sort of lock and key mechanism to the molecules that are providing that help, it's hard to see how they're going to avoid being exploited by someone who's not making those molecules that are being exchanged, right? You can certainly imagine that there's some signaling system where things become more complicated. There's a guy called Avigdor Elder who works in Israel who works on a problem that is a bit like this, that has to do with bacterial signaling back and forth with each other, and there's very complicated evolutionary behavior where things look like they're trying to avoid bad interactions in complicated two-way signaling. So I'm not going to say that you can rule out that any such thing could occur, but anything that involves a simple exchange of nutrients, you know, I make glucose, you produce. Well, okay, so I can give you an example. So we published a paper where you can force an alga and a fungus to help each other's growth. So the algae can't use glucose, and so if you cap the flask, there's no CO2 available. So the fungus metabolizes the glucose and makes carbon dioxide, which the algae are then going to use for photosynthesis because you shine light. And yeast and many other fungi can't use nitrite as a nitrogen source. But algae can reduce nitrite, and so when they do that, some of the ammonia leaks out, and the fungi can benefit from that. So that's a two-way mutualism. And it's hard to see in that situation how you would discriminate against, you know, if there's a cost to the algae of reducing the nitrite, how you discriminate against someone who decided not to reduce it. And we didn't do that as an evolution experiment. That's just a co-culture experiment. And so I think the short answer to your question is it's hard to envisage, but not impossible. Yes?
Because all your arguments about the cheaters was based on the plant cell lineage phase. So you have any mutation which is actually monolineage?
Absolutely right. So one of the things that we brought with us is so John was interested in this question, and so he engineered cells that would stick to his clumps but not make invertase. So this is like the lamprey sticking to the shark. Okay. And so what he did is passage those guys, but in each passage he would remove the cheats, and so he was trying to evolve the clumps to fend off the cheats in some way, right? So there are all sorts of interesting evolutionary dynamics you can play like that. And so in his case, he did it by construction rather than waiting for things to evolve. But yeah, if things are non-lineage based, life gets much more complicated, and then there should be pressure for the good guys to evolve to recognize the bad guys and somehow fend them off, and the contact-dependent inhibition that some of the groups are working on. Maybe this, you know, one possibility for the evolution of systems like that is they're designed precisely for that sort of discrimination.
This, well, that's kind of related to this question, I suppose, but it feels like it's like a toy model of cancer in some way. Those purple guys.
Yes, and so one of the things, so we have a long-term collaboration with David Nelson, who's a very distinguished condensed matter theorist. And one of the things that David's very interested about is range expansions. And so, and actually Oscar and David started doing this. And so we've done some things like together to look at like range expansion of mutualists. And one of the things that David's very interested in, as am I, is looking at range expansions in three dimensions, because now the theory and the behavior of things gets to be very different. And so some of these things could actually be regarded as the model for both the evolution and statistical properties of mutations in cancer, and with exactly as you said, the sort of thing that Mary did, you could make even models for non-cooperating cells and stuff like that. Yeah, so there are things we can do.